Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So this is the fourth Wednesday night talk during this rains retreat 2006. It's a time when the meditation should be starting to bite, when because of the lack of distraction in this monastic community, and because the emphasis is always going inside, staying in one's room, in one's hut, spending a lot of time in solitude, spending a lot of time going inside the mind, there's a degree of stillness starts to build up. And that stillness happens through its natural causes. Hopefully it becomes quite clear to each one here that you don't get stillness by making it happen. When you try to make things happen, you only get restlessness, you disturb the mind. But stillness happens in spite of all of the wriggling of the delusion of self. We try to gain our deep meditation, we struggle to follow the path, we try and gain insight and understanding of the Dhamma. There comes a time when you realize that all that struggling and striving is going against the whole purpose, that all the struggling and the craving and the wriggling and the complaining and the judging and the wanting and the being disappointed, all those arguments all come from this great delusion of a self. You even think there's somebody in there who's calling the shots is a great delusion. However, that we find if we stay the course which is given in these monasteries, that if we continue this practice, the practice happens in spite of us. It's wonderful to see that it's happening. It's got nothing to do with our abilities or lack of abilities, who we are, what our background is, our intelligence, our lack of intelligence, our gender, our status, all those things become completely irrelevant. Even our age is irrelevant. We find that if we have a situation, an external support of quietness, where our physical needs are supplied very easily without taking up too much time, where we're put in situations where you look at the trees, every tree looks the same. Okay, there are Mary trees, there are Wonders, there are Jarrah trees, and all sorts of other maybe trees I don't know about, but they're all gum trees to me. In other words, you look around and they're all the same. And after a while you stop looking around on the outside. There's a certain evenness about a monastery which turns one inside, because there's nothing changing so quickly outside. And so because there's nothing to grab one's attention in the forest, very often one turns inside. Turns inside to look what's happening in the mind. And this becomes a natural process which one can hardly resist. Sure, it takes time for some, but those who want the fast path will just get out of the way and let it happen. And this fast path is just allowing stillness to grow inside one's heart. The word stillness is my favorite term for samadhi. There's been many translations or renderings of that term over the years, and I've used different ones over my lifetime as a monk. But at this age of being a monk, I prefer the word stillness, because that evokes the meaning of the word, but also the way to achieve that meaning. To gain enough stillness inside the heart, the things stop moving. And that stillness is what we mean by samadhi. It is an equipoise of the mind, where not just the mind stops moving, but the whole world stops moving. For those of you who remember what it's like outside of these walls, for those of you who have to drive the van to go outside or have to do things, you just notice how fast that world moves beyond these walls. I still even recall now the very first sort of retreat which I did as a young student, going to this Tibetan sort of monastery in Scotland. And there, spending about a week or 2 weeks, and I was a very diligent meditator even then, and just when I left that monastery, just how much people were racing around. And it's just so easy to see once you'd been in some degree of stillness for a couple of weeks, just the madness of that world. But that madness of the world is, when one comes to the monastery, one leaves that, but one hasn't left far enough. Because the madness of the world is now replaced by the madness of your mind. The mind which is always striving and craving to try and achieve something, to make something happen, to arrange everything. The Buddha sometimes called that the house builder. It doesn't mean like a physical house, but it means that all those other monuments which one builds where one can hang out, all one's dreams and goals and projects and achievements. And you can see just the way that the mind is always constructing things, constructing strategies of what you're going to do next, even constructing how you're going to meditate in the next half hour, what you're going to do when this talk leaves. There's that constructing part of the mind is called sankharas. It forms not just the future, but it deforms the present moment. Deforming it means it sacrifices the peace and the stillness and the happiness and wisdom which comes from that stillness. It sacrifices the moment for a promise of something, sometime in the future. Once one sees the whole process happening, one starts to suss out, to see through the con, the fraud of desire and wanting. Wanting promises you so much, but as soon as you reach what you wanted, you find it's not what you expected. As they always say, that wanting is always unfaithful to its goal. As soon as it reaches it, it throws away its goal, discards it, and just wants something more. And for those of you who go on the path of forever wanting something else, you find there's never any peace, there's never any stillness, there's never any freedom. In the paradigm, in the framework of Buddhism, we see that craving as the cause of suffering. We don't see it as something which we celebrate. We see it as like an enemy to our happiness. In the world that people celebrate their ability to want, to crave, to desire, to struggle. But after a while of struggling and wanting and craving and desiring and wanting this and wanting that, we should be able to see it's never satisfied us, it's never given us the goods that it has promised. It's delusory, it's fraudulent, it's a cheat. It promises, but never supplies what it promises. So after a while, one stops that path and goes on the path of stillness. And you can actually see when you call this path of meditation a path of stillness, you can see just that it is that house builder, the wanting which creates the waves which disturb the surface of the mind. It is the wanting which shakes the mind. It's what makes it move and wobble and takes it away from its natural stillness. But there are times when either through sheer frustration, when you've just been thinking, struggling, wanting and just got nowhere and had enough, sometimes that frustration can be useful. Sometimes when you go up the wall, as it were, up the wall there's nowhere to go but to down and to jump off and throw it all away. And sometimes that degree of letting go, when you stop the wanting, you find at last some stillness. And those times when you experience stillness, they're the times when insight arises. They arise not because you see something magical or some Four Noble Truths or dependent origination, because you see stillness itself. Just the very obvious thing is sometimes the most profound. When the mind becomes still, there in that stillness, there is a pause, there is an end of suffering, there is a freedom, there is a tranquility, there is a joy. It is the taste of freedom. The stillness, even in its first forms, even when it's just like a young baby, just beginning to stand in your mind but falling over so often, when it first appears, it should be able to give you that insight that this seems to be the path. This does seem to be the way out of suffering. As the Buddha said, Samadhi Maggo, that stillness is the path. Asamadhi Kumaggo, no stillness is no path. And when one finds that degree of stillness and has just even a taste of stillness, a pause between the moving of the mind, just the 1 millisecond where everything stops, just to be able to realize that much should give you the light at the end of the tunnel, the crack in the facade of samadhi, the crack in the facade of samsara. It's actually to see that there is a possibility of stillness and the freedom which that gives. So it's my goal, it's my work to try and encourage moments of stillness in each one of you. Until there are so many moments of stillness, the message comes up very loud and clear that it's the stillness is the path, and the enemy of stillness is the wanting. So we meditate and we create the mindfulness depending upon our practice. When the mind starts to wake up and become clearer, when you start to see more and feel more and understand more, simply because the mind is just waking up, rubbing its eyes, taking off the dust in front of the eyes so it can see clearly. When it starts to see clearly, it starts to understand that this is freedom, the stillness of the mind, the not wanting, the end of craving. Just leaving things alone, not encouraging the sense of self. Sometimes that when we do this, there is also the insight that as we become still, there's a fear. That fear, that resistance, that obstacle is always coming from a fear of losing something. And it's always the case that fear is a threat of taking away something which you're attached to, something which you build your identity on. Fear is always a good sign in meditation. It shows that you are untying the knots which bind you to samsara. When that fear comes up, just leave it alone. It's part of the path. It shows that something is happening. And soon you just let go of those attachments, those things which you identify with, those things which you think you are, which create your identity, yourself. They disappear little by little. The less you do, the more you vanish. And you can see just the people who do a lot are the ones with the big egos. That's why they call it the control freak. And part of this path is allowing that control freak to very gradually, very gently disappear, to fade until it all vanishes. When there's no one left inside, there's no one left to do the controlling, nothing left to do the doing, nothing left to disturb the mind. and the mind becomes still, naturally so. However, until that happens, the more that you are agitated, the more suffering and problems you have during this retreat. It's a sign of just how much work you still have to do, how big that ego still is. As that ego gets whittled away, as you realize that the self, the ego, which is doing all these things, it only wants to have that happiness, to have that peace, to have that fulfillment and feel freedom. That's the only thing it ever wants anyway. And every time it struggles, it defeats its own purpose. Instead of getting what it wanted, the peace, the freedom, the satisfaction, it only gets more trouble and more suffering. How often is it that you've just made more suffering for yourself, made more problems in your life, whenever you've got into control mode? There are times when we just abandon and let go. There are times when it may be you're just so fed up with your meditation, you just sit down, I don't care. And you get into these beautiful, peaceful states of mind. It may only be a few moments, but it shows you something very important. It shows you the heart of what we're supposed to be doing. Abandoning the sense of self. Abandoning craving. Letting go of the khandhas. Allowing everything to become still. As it says in the suttas, the sabbe sankhara samatha, to calm down, to settle all of these forming things, all of these builders, all of these doers. A lot of the time you're not allowed to do that. You have your duties to perform in the world. But here on a retreat, you've so arranged it, you've got so little to do. Because you have so little to do, do very little. And where we do very little, where we find that we have to go through sloth and torpor first of all. It's just par for the course. A mind which is very active, which has always been doing so much, which has been writing letters, planning things, doing research, talking to people. A mind such as that will become tired when it makes a change over from activity to almost 100% passivity. It has to go through the sloth and torpor stage. All it means is the doer is being quietened down, but the knower has not yet got enough energy. It's still a good sign, so don't be concerned about sloth and torpor if that's happening in your meditation. Be still. Don't struggle. Don't seek for sloth and torpor, but don't seek to abandon it. Don't seek to sleep too much. Don't seek to get up too early. Allow this to happen on a natural way. You wake up in the morning, just get up. No need to carry on sleeping. If you're dreaming too much, that's a sign that you're sleeping too much. The mind is active, you don't need to lay down. You get much more fun, much more joy, being vertical than being horizontal. The thing I said last time, people who spend a lot of time sleeping in the horizontal position may get reborn as horizontal beings, otherwise known as Tirachana Gata, the animals. Animals, Tirachana Gata means those who go along horizontal. So be careful. So instead be vertical. And vertical means that you can become more still and enjoy it. When you start this process of stillness, it is difficult at first. There comes a time, and sometimes you can't resist this period. You've followed the teachings enough. You haven't resisted. You've done the work, you've been meditating, walking and sitting, sleeping not so much, staying by yourself, not wasting your time, but putting in the hours. When you put in the hours, it has to happen. I can't see any other alternative, that the mind will come to states of stillness. And those states of stillness will energize the mind. And then you start to get mindfulness. I was planning, sort of, to give a talk on the seven enlightenment factors of Bojangas today, starting off with mindfulness. I took a long time to get to that mindfulness. That's what the mindfulness really means. The awareness, which is coupled with the energy. You know when you are really mindful, when the mind is happy and it can just see things with more clarity than in one's usual daily life. If you've been practicing properly, you will find that just what you see, what you hear, even what you taste, is more rich than in your normal, frantic daily lives. Simply because the energy has started to flow into just mindfulness. It's why I'm not quite sure why more people don't mention this point, but if you even read in the suttas, this mindfulness is mentioned at many, many different times. At many different parts of the gradual training. And every time the mindfulness has a different power to it. And you always notice, according to the suttas, the most powerful mindfulness, where it's perfectly pure, is in the fourth jhana. Well, that's what we mean by really powerful mindfulness. And those of you who have had experiences of meditation, just know what happens after you've got some degree of stillness in the mind. The mindfulness changes its character. Simply, it is more powerful. It can see more, it can hear more, it can feel more, it can know more. It is literally the lights of your mind going up. That's an important thing to know, because too often people think that mindfulness is just something ordinary. But when one develops the energy of the mind, now by not doing so much, the energy of the mind increases, and one realizes through your own experience what mindfulness can do, how powerful it can be. And for me, it's always strong mindfulness is always accompanied by strong piti, sukha and joy. That's a sign that mindfulness is powerful, when it's accompanied by happiness. People who are depressed have low mindfulness. It's a shame, really, because then they just can't see why they're depressed. Their mindfulness is just disabled. It's not strong enough to get themselves out of the hole which they have dug. The deeper the hole, the darker it is down there. You just can't see. When one comes up to the surface, everything is bright and light. The higher one goes, the brighter it is, and the more joyful it is. So this is one of the beautiful parts about the path of meditation. When one starts getting into it, not only is it amazing what one uncovers, what one sees, but the sheer joy of it is just so wonderful, so fulfilling. And you're understanding that this is what the mind always wanted, and this is how it works. Stillness, bringing up mindfulness, bringing up joy. And that starts to increase. So the understanding of Dhamma. Always have the mindfulness, the first factor of the enlightenment factors. And that gives rise to, they say, Dhamma Vicaya. I didn't say actually Dhamma Vitakka, because Dhamma Vitakka is like thinking about the Dhamma. And you know, last week and a previous weeks, I really hammered, thinking. Just as if it was just a real terrible monster. And it is a monster. Dhamma Vicaya is more like just investigating, seeing the truth, the underlying causes behind things. When one starts to investigate, going in and understanding just the whys of this mind and this world, this is where, again, just the mindfulness uncovers these incredible insights into the nature of you, the nature of happiness. Sometimes it's sad to see people suffering all the time, having a hard time, getting depressed, getting angry, getting fed up, getting afraid. And they carry on like that throughout their whole life, not just this life, but many lives, and they never see why. And sometimes they just run away, they go some other place, go here, go there, and that's like the simile of the Buddha, which was Ajahn Chah's simile of the dog with mange. Wherever it goes, it's always itchy. It's not the place which is the problem. It's just not seeing clearly. One doesn't see clearly because one is not still enough to build up enough mindfulness, enough energy to penetrate what is really going on. Don't you really want to find out what's going on in your life, in your mind, in your body, and find out really, truly, not just to go on by belief, not to be full of doubts on what to do and how to do it, which is the right path, and can I do this or can I not do this, and all those doubt business is just like a mist. And that mist in the early morning is completely burnt away by the rising sun. And it's the same way just when this energy of mindfulness comes up, and it's just so strong, it burns away the mist of doubt. Once you have enough stillness to build enough mindfulness to have it energetic, there's no doubt at all what you should be doing or what the path is. It's so clear, and it's not just through reading, it's through your experience. You have to see it. What you actually see is just all of those problems which create difficulties for human beings. All coming from this craving, from this wanting, from this struggling, from this desiring. And that's all coming, the wanting, the struggling, the craving, is always coming from this stupid delusion that there's somebody in here to do all of this. That this all belongs to you, that this is your kuti, this is your body, this is your robe, this is your family, this is your monastery, this is your whatever. So all that mine causes the trouble. When you look so deeply, you can allow all of this to disappear. Even for a few moments, to think, I own nothing. Not even my thoughts, not even my mind. I don't own my meditation. I don't own anything. To be someone who is a true renunciant. The more you renounce, the more you're following the third noble truth. It's called patinissagga, fully renouncing, throwing things away. It's called the path to nibbana, one of the four ways of letting go, throwing things away. So it's great being able to do that in your meditation. You're sitting there, what can I throw away now? What mental attitude can I discard? What possession can I abandon? It's just like throwing things out of your mind, like you throw things out of your hut, until you just got empty hut. But then, of course, in Buddhism, we just really go for broke. We throw out the walls. We throw out the space between the walls. We get into this really amazing, even concepts get thrown out. Everything disappears. And that's jhanas, when things get that empty. And the body's gone and will is gone. And then the mind, you throw that out, and you get into arupas, and even fully throw out the mind, and then there's nothing left. That's nirodha. Everything you throw out, even the one who does the throwing out, everything disappears. Till there's nothing left at all, cessation. Full emptiness. And that's real fun, to do things like that. And don't think you can't do it. Just keep on throwing things away. The more you throw away, the closer you are to emptiness. And so this becomes our little path. See how much we can allow to fade away, especially of the one inside, the doer, the maker. And so that when we do this, you know, we find that we get this incredible peace. What was the next one? I say, from sati, dhamma, vicaya, viriya. This is this energy business. This energy comes naturally. Sometimes that we try and do things and will things, it doesn't ever happen. We haven't got the strength to even to meditate sometimes. We haven't got the strength to give up our defilements. We haven't got the strength to do things. This viriya, this heroic energy. But there is a case for saying that for mindfulness, from investigating Dhamma, the energy starts to come up. It's a natural energy. It comes up from Dhamma and from strong mindfulness. And it's great having that degree of energy. And it's natural when the mindfulness becomes strong. The less you do, the more energy you have. That's what Ajahn Chah did. From stillness we get mental energy. So from the samadhi, we start to have this incredible, powerful energy. But it's also, as I mentioned I think last week, it's heroic energy, from the word viro, the hero, simply because it's able to abandon things. It's able to actually to throw more things away, to sacrifice its very essence, like the warrior does not really think about protecting its life. Or like that simile of the Buddha, like the warrior elephant, who doesn't try to protect its trunk, doesn't try and protect its flanks, doesn't try and protect its legs or its tail, but will sacrifice everything for the commander. In the same way that we're willing to sacrifice everything, every part of our being, and then we are the heroic warrior. This is what we mean by letting go, abandoning the whole lot as much as we can. And this is what mindfulness starts to encourage us to do. The more you let go, the more energy and happiness you have. A favorite saying in the Jatakas, the more you abandon the five senses, the more happiness you feel. And if you want to experience complete happiness, then completely abandon the five senses. Saying of the Buddha. So this is, we completely abandon these things. Let them go. Throw them away. And we get this incredible energy. And it's fun having energy. And you know what it's like when you're really tired or when you're really sick and you can't do things and life becomes so dim and meaningless and depressing. But simply by following this path, you get the energy up. Once you start having those three things, you have enough mindfulness. And hopefully your mindfulness is beginning to grow now, if you've been practicing stillness, not doing so much. Hopefully that the investigation using your wisdom is growing. And with it the energy, the heroic energy, which has abandoned a little and got so much happiness and power, and it's willing to abandon a bit more. And from that, the next stage is, this is where you really get into the fun stuff. You get passadi, the beautiful tranquility of the body and the mind. First of all, tranquility of the body, where you can just sit, not want to move, where you can just walk on your path and just be so content with just walking, not wanting to change your posture. That is also passadi of the body, the tranquility of the body. So next week I'm going to be 55. Many of you are much older than me. Just, you know, when you get to those sorts of ages, just the body is just such a pain. It always wants to go to the toilet or cough or eat or drink or do something or other. It's always a pain. But it's one of the wonderful things about being able to meditate. You can sit there and all the pain disappears. All the stomach ache goes. All of the whatever else you've got, indigestion, it just vanishes when the body becomes still. And for those of you who have achy bodies, old, worn out bodies, it's such a relief to get to Kaya Prasadi. It's a place of real comfort. It's like having a lazy boy armchair in your hut. It's much better than those lazy boys. That's the type of armchair. Or better than a queen bed or whatever. Sometimes you might lay on these beds. Sometimes when I've been going to some of these Buddhist summits or sometimes they put you up in these hotels and got these huge beds and sometimes you try and sleep on them but eventually we end up on the floor. It's more comfortable down there. But sometimes even the most amazing beds are just nowhere near as comfortable as just being able to sit in samadhi and see the whole body become so still and so tranquil. And all the aches and pains disappear. You just sit there and just the body feels at ease. What a wonderful thing that is to experience the prasadi of the body. And even those of you who are not all that old yet, even so, there's always some sort of ache going on. It's too hot, it's too cold, you just got a backache or your muscles are a bit sore. I remember hearing this from a lay teacher many, many years ago when she said, look, why do people move so much? Look at them, they're always scratching something or fidgeting. They're always moving. Why do they move their body continuously? You can actually just look at a person and just see just how they're fidgeting their fingers or fidgeting their body or coughing or whatever. And they're doing that because the body is just so uncomfortable. They're always, every few seconds, needing to do something with it. But in meditation, you can get so still, you can just sit there for hours, not moving at all. Not needing to move. At last, the irritation of a physical body is transcended. You just sit. You don't need to scratch. You don't need to go to the toilet. You don't need to fidget. You don't need to move at all. It's comfort. You never get that on a bed. Even when you're sleeping, you're always having to turn over and move, scratch or whatever. But in meditation, it is the most comfortable you can ever get. You don't need a queen bed or a lazy boy. You just need a nice quiet place, a cushion if you like, and just cross your legs and let go. A wonderful thing it is to know prasadi of the body, and to know it doesn't need any expensive furniture. All it needs is a trained mind. Trained in mindfulness, trained just to investigate the causes of all these problems, abandon the causes with heroic effort, coming not from a self, but just coming from the energy of mindfulness, and just see everything become so quiet and tranquil. Just to get that much, it's wonderful what you've done. Because hardly anybody in this world knows physical tranquility. And so few people can actually sit still. That's why the world is always rushing. Just in the Saturday evening Word of the Buddha class, whenever I come across this phrase of the Buddha, I said, beings obstructed by ignorance, or sometimes say blinded by delusion, and sort of led around the nose by craving, always hurrying and hastening through samsara. I always like those words, hurrying and hastening. Because people, just the Buddha noticed that this was not the rat race of the 21st century. This is 2500 years ago. People even then would hurry through samsara. Some of you may be hurrying through this rain retreat. How many weeks to go? Hastening through your life. What are you doing that for? Because you're not tranquil. You're not still. After a while, when you get tranquility, there's no more hurrying or hastening. There's comfort. And the thing with the body is, you know, that that comfort arises not by pandering to the body, not by trying to get the most comfortable seat, not by scratching, not by feeding, not by air-conning your hut, just by letting it go, by not bothering with it anymore, realizing this body is not me, it's not mine, nothing to do with me, it's just a body, just bones, flesh. When you understand that, you just let it go. The result of letting go is tranquility, and that is a joy. And you should be very happy that you've got that much. You can sit quietly without needing to bother the body. You're comfortable. And that comfort of the body, and you know the cause of that comfort of the body, should tell you how to get the same comfort of the mind. You don't get comfortable with the body and get that stillness of the body by putting it in the best position. Nor do you get comfort and stillness of the mind by raising it just so. The only way you get comfort and that same stillness of the mind is by doing exactly the same. It's nothing to do with me, this mind. Watching the breath and not watching the breath is not my business. Whatever objects of the mind that don't belong to me, even this thing inside which tries to do the meditation, that is a complete delusion. There's nothing there to do the meditation. If you try and make up this controller, you're just making up the cause of suffering. You find you can't control the mind that way, no more than you can physically, through will, hold the body still and get the same degree of comfort as when you just let the body go. The way to Kaya Prasadi, tranquility of the body, you should investigate that and apply the same procedure to getting tranquility of the mind. Not controlling the mind, but disengaging. That's why the path of meditation is disengaging, just like the gears of a vehicle. They're just the cogs, they just separate from the grooves, so that one can be whirring around but doesn't make the other one move. So the world outside can be moving, but this inner cog doesn't move at all. And after a while, there's no transmission. Things stop. They wear out. This is what we mean by disengaging. This thing inside which creates all the movement is quelled. And because the thing inside which creates the moving is quelled, what you watch settles down. Because you don't do anything, the object of the mind, what you take as your meditation experience, settles down by itself. Sometimes we say, meditation, what are we doing? We're watching this experience that we call our meditation. We want it to settle down. But we can't make it settle down because we don't know what's causing the agitation. When you find out what causes the mind to be agitated, what separates it from stillness, why can't I get still and calm in my meditation? Find out the cause of this, and you find it's coming from deep within you. Just like that old simile, which I've given before, I think it's in the book coming out this month, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Of the cinema screens in the days when people would smoke in the cinema halls, and you see the movie on the screen, but there was a cone of light because the beam from the projector would hit these particles of smoke, and so you could see this very clear cone of light being very wide at the screen. You could trace it back to where it came from, and because it was getting more and more contracted, when you followed it back, you could see where it was coming from. The cone was coming to a point in this little room behind the cinema where the projectionist was. You could actually see what the movie was. You could trace it back to its source. The why were all these pictures moving on this screen? When you found out what the source was, then you could detach very easily. It's just a movie, that's all. there's light going through a piece of plastic, piece of celluloid, nothing more than that. When you actually see the source of these things, it makes life more easy. They say, why is my mind restless? Where does it come from? It's always because you are interfering. And once you actually see that and stop interfering and leaving it alone, then things become very still, just like your body becomes still when you leave it alone. So too your mind becomes still. If your mind doesn't become still, if the fantasies, the dreams, the restlessness, the thought, the plans, the memories, they still keep invading your mind, it means you haven't disengaged yet. That you are still pushing those thoughts through the mind. So it's great to be able to see that. It's great to be able to let go enough to see the mind become absolutely still. It's just still and you're not making it still. You're not holding it still. It's not through force. No more than when your body is still that you're physically holding it still. It's just still all by itself. And there you've got citta prasadi, the tranquility of the mind. And of course, you know what happens next, you get this beautiful sukha, you got happy at last. The fruits of monastic life are beginning to appear for you. You're a happy meditator. And I don't need to say again, but I will say it again. Those happinesses you get when you follow this path and you do it properly, that you're patient enough, that you disengage enough, you don't become this person who's always doing it your way, you're doing it no way, you're not doing it at all. When you become someone like that, you'll find that the happiness just starts to get to extreme levels. And I'm a happy meditator and I have great fun on these retreats. And just, whenever, you know, I'm also compassionate. Whenever I get so much fun, I just want to parcel it up like my birthday cake and give everyone a slice of the happiness which I feel. This is what I give talks for, what I'm a teacher for, to try and share out the cake of happiness which I've got from meditation. And it's the most delicious cake you can ever imagine. So the happiness you get from a still mind is extreme, and it's blissful, and it's fruitful, and it doesn't, it's a happiness which is based on letting go. It's not a happiness based on getting things, that's why it's so stable. It's a happiness which is based on conditions, those conditions disappear and the happiness goes. They change and the happiness wobbles. But the happiness which is based on emptiness, it's not standing on anything. It's standing on nothing. It's the free happiness. It's the base state of the mind. And that's why that happiness lasts. And it's got this taste of freedom. Big time freedom. At last you begin to understand what religions were supposed to be about. Why we've got spiritual sages, why there are saints, these Aryas, these Kubarajans, and what motivates them, and why this path has lasted so long. What are you doing here to taste that bliss of a still mind? I'm not talking even of jhanas yet. Because when you start to get still, oh, this is just so nice. And those states which need to be put in their proper perspective, they are noble, they are holy. Anyone who can meditate and have a wonderful time, well done. This is praising the jewel of samadhi. And once you start praising the jewel of samadhi, the beautiful stages of mind, you got the, was it, prasadi leads to sukha. And then the sukha eventually has to, once you get to those stages, you get into this happy states of mind, you love meditating, and you don't really need to sort of be pushed anymore, sometimes you can't hold a person back, they just go for it, and they got no choice, because the mind just seeks that peace, that happiness, its natural right. And at last you understand what this life is all about. You've got some meaning. And this is not just some theory. It's not just some argument. It's an experience which you're just right there in front of you, which you cannot deny. You've got some powerful realizations at last in your life. Your monastic life, your holy life, your religious life, your philosophical life is starting to get some solid fruits. At last I know the happiness of a peaceful mind. And the insights to start come rolling thick and fast. This all comes from letting go of the sense of self, letting go of craving, letting go of the body, letting go of the five senses. These five senses, this body, this doing, this going here and going there, that is suffering. It's what the Buddha meant by that first noble truth. And you're seeing it, you're experiencing it. And the more you see and experience that, and then you compare it with the suttas, and you start to cry with joy. You're seeing what the Buddha saw. You're seeing what all these great Aryas of 26 centuries have seen. And they may have been in India, they may have been in Thailand, and here you are in Australia, and you're following the same path. If you can actually see yourself, or your no-self, or whatever, your five-kanda process on that stage. You know exactly what's happening and why it's happening. You're going in the same way. You're in the footsteps of the noble ones. And not as a theory, it's the experience. You understand why these areas which are such happy people. You've got that happiness inside of yourself. And that happiness just stays. Stays with you for the whole life. Happiness of freedom. And it just develops. And sometimes you get so happy you just go straight into the jhana states. The full samadhi. And remember what those samadhi states are. Even deeper states of stillness. When you talk about stillness, sometimes that there's so many different levels of stillness. You get to one level and you think, wow, so still. You just stay there for a while. And it goes to the next level of stillness. We're not, something disappears. Something which once moved has now stopped moving. And that's how you know it's a different level of stillness. There's something else which was moving, stopped moving. There's something else which was moving, stops and disappears. There's different levels of stillness where more and more things disappear. This becomes your bliss. Becomes your happiness. It becomes your joy. Becomes why you're in a monastery. Why you wake up in the morning and meditate. Becomes more meaningful than anything else which you do. You start getting into the bliss states of the mind. Bliss born of letting go. Which is no part of attachments, no part of unwholesome things. You're just getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the Dhamma. And it becomes more and more inspiring. And all those things which one wanted to become a monk for, you're now tasting them for yourself. And you realize this path is still valid. And people still, from all walks of life, still gain the same paths and fruits as they did in the time of the Buddha. The Buddha said, if anyone walks the Eightfold Path, this is what happens. And sometimes people refuse to walk that Eightfold Path. Instead of following the teachings, they try and make their own teachings up. Too much doing, too much controlling, too much self, too much me, too much individual control. As one lets go, samadhi. And in the samadhi, in the stillness, you get the final stage of upekkha. Just looking on. That's one of the meanings of upekkha. Equanimity is the usual translation. But its root meaning is just looking on. But not interfering, being mindful without touching what one is mindful of, without making it quiver, without soiling it with one's dirty hands. One just watches. And what does one watch? One just watches the play of the five khandhas. This is what form is. This is what Vedana is. This is what perception is. Just what Sankara is. It's just will, completely conditioned, nothing to do with me, all caused from external factors, nothing internal. And consciousness itself. Just consciousness being consciousness, but not my possession. You become the real monk, not even possessing a bowl and a robe. That's why I was always taught the bowl and robe belongs to the Buddha, it doesn't belong to me. It's my inheritance from the Buddha, but it's not my possession. Even less is any jhana my possession. That too is like an inheritance from a Buddha, something which the Buddha left to each one of us in great abundance. Just people just don't want to go into the treasury to take it out. They just leave it there and go somewhere else. And the paths and fruits and enlightenment doesn't belong to you. That is so obvious, because it's the ending of a self. No more me. And once you get so close to the ending of a self, it's such a relief. Whenever there's a you inside, there's so much to be done, so much to be argued against, so much to be resisted, so much trouble and turmoil and things to do. It's so tiring having a self. And in the end, one just lets it go. One has to, there's no choice. In the end, there's freedom. Vimutti. To know that you've done the job at last. And it's not the brownie badge or the scout badge, as I was saying the other week. It's just all the badges have gone. There's no place to stick them anymore. This idea of a self has been completely abandoned. Seen through in bliss. Seen through samadhi, seen through by following the Noble Eightfold Path. And then you can look back, just as I used to say when chanting the Bojangas, the Seven Enlightenment Factors, and all these monks like Kassapa and was it Chunda, and eventually the Buddha, they saw that, yeah, these things were in me, Sariputta. They saw the Enlightenment Factors were there, and they rejoiced even more in seeing this timeless path had been manifested in their own lives. And that through that practice, which all started just so simply, just by sitting down meditating and letting go of the doer, started so simply and got to just extremes of profundity, and going through the biggest stages of bliss and ecstasy that is available for human beings or devas in this cosmos, in samsara. You're going to the heights of bliss and ecstasy. You go through all that way to emptiness, to nirvana, to the ending of all things, because the self has ended. And then you can look back and say, house builder, I've seen you, now you have been destroyed. The sense of self and all this doing which it constructed has now been uprooted, abandoned. Once it has been abandoned and uprooted, it can't establish itself anymore. You can't have anything being written in emptiness or growing out of nothing. At last it's all finished with. And you get blissed out. So this is a great path of stillness, of tranquility, of bliss, just like Buddhist monks are supposed to be doing. Buddhist monks are supposed to be peaceful people, people who are unworldly, forgiving, not carrying too many possessions around, people who have just left the world. And this is how you leave the world. You don't just leave the world by putting on a robe and eating one meal a day. And people can actually bring the world into their hearts with radios and stuff and books and newspapers or magazines. But imagine just really leaving the world. That's what it means. It's leaving the world of a self, of a doer, of a controller. And do that as soon as you can. You've got this beautiful rains retreat. Everything, all the conditions are just perfect. All you need to do is just to get out of the way and allow those conditions to take over. Hand over the keys to the practice and stop being the driver. Stop being the backseat driver. Stop doing it your way. Stop resisting, for goodness sake. This is peace. This is bliss on offer. Just sit. Watch the mind. Get that peace and that tranquility. Experiment. See what happens if you can just trust and let go completely. And every time you do, rejoice in that. Rejoice in the joy of the mind which is released. Released from the burden of the self. Which is released from the canker. The canker were these little, I found out the other day, there was these little ball and chains which were, people used to torture, used to put around prisoners. So your canker is taken off. You can imagine what it was like to be one of these prisoners 100, 200 years ago. They put this fetter, this metal ring around your ankles with a chain, this big heavy metal ball on the end. Imagine sort of dragging that up to the hill, up from the your heart in the bottom of the hill, up to the Dhanasala for breakfast in the morning, and dragging it back again. This is all done away with. You're free, liberated. So this is what's there for you. So try and practice that tranquility. Develop stillness. Make that the great word in this retreat period. See how still you can be, how little you can move. When the mind does move or the body moves, investigate why, what caused it to move. Find out that answer. And once you see the reason, the causes, it's very easy to abandon the causes. And then the stillness grows. Mindfulness increases. Insight happens. Bliss is yours. And freedom, even the ultimate freedom, becomes your experience. A wonderful thing that will be for each one of you during this retreat. Doors of the deathless are open. Just walk through. It's a talk this evening.